Friends, I'm very happy to meet you all again, and I can well understand that this is not a very good day for many people to come out. And so for those who are here, I'm very grateful to you for that. But the most important thing, I feel, is the contact, because it doesn't often happen that people from India have opportunity to meet people from New Zealand or the other way around. And I do feel that these are very important occasions. And even though one meets a very few people, because the tour is a very short one, well, it's very nice to meet even those few. And I suppose really traveling around and seeing the world is a great education. And the whole subject of today's talk is a changing world. Sometimes I suppose one feels that in some places the world doesn't change at all. And whether we are even conscious of what is happening in the rest of the world, that is the thing we have to think about. And one does get a feeling, I don't know whether it's correct or incorrect, I myself feel as if I am in another world when I am here, because it seems so very far away, and there is a feeling in the newspapers are not very effective in giving you very much contact with other countries or other cultures, other religions and so on. And I do not know exactly how people here feel, but certainly in Australia some of them were saying to me that they felt as if the rest of the world was another globe and they were somewhere else, perhaps it may be another planet. And they felt out of touch with what is going on, and there was even a kind of a sense of security, even at the great times of trial of the world, which is a very good thing to feel on the one hand, and it's a very bad thing to feel on the other, because actually we should not allow that sense of security to lead us into a feeling of contentment, a stagnant contentment. It should actually produce an inner urge for greater knowledge, inner urge to know something about what the other people are thinking and so on. Generally speaking, I should say, in the world, coming from India, I can definitely say that the India knows much more about the West than the West really knows about India. Partly because we have had not only a great contact with Western people by the Western rule that has existed, but Western influences have penetrated so much in Eastern countries that East is becoming very positively West conscious. The question that has to be asked is whether the West is becoming East conscious. I think until comparatively lately, it was not very East conscious, because generally in the West, Western politicians and Western people, when they speak about the world, they think in terms of the world composed of the Western civilization. Of course, I do not really know whether New Zealand and Australia, whether you are Western or Eastern. Geographically, you are Eastern. You are much nearer to the East than you are to the West. But culturally, you are definitely Western, because your outlook is Western, your thought is Western, your philosophy, your religion, everything is. And yet, somehow or other, in the whole world, they subconsciously, they associate certain things with the world. For example, what would you call Africa? Is it Western or Eastern? Certainly, it is much more Western, geographically, than New Zealand. But yet, I suppose you would not say that the African civilization is a Western civilization. You can't even say that it is an Eastern civilization in one sense, but except in the fact that they are a different color. Unconsciously, I think majority of people think of the West as white and the East as dark brown or black or whatever varieties of shades we have. Evidently, in the darker countries, we have more varieties of shades than you have in the Western countries, except in the hair and the eyes, because we always have, nearly always, black hair and dark eyes. But otherwise, our skin has more variety, and people have made the differentiation on this basis of the skin. But there is also the background of psychology which has to be thought about, and there is no doubt that the Eastern mentality as such has a character of its own which is quite different from the West. Now, one of the many things that has been changing in the world has been the gradual consciousness of the Western civilization towards the East. Unfortunately, the changes in the world have not come only because the Western world was unsatisfied or longed for a change of approach to its ideas. I suppose, in a way, dissatisfaction does exist to a certain degree, because it is dissatisfaction that always gives birth to the searching for something new. And in that, I should think, we must accept the fact that it is the younger generation that has been greatly responsible to many social and other changes. At all times in the world, people have felt that the young people are unsatisfactory, that they are rebellious, and they have never followed the ways of the older generation. I do not know how our older generation felt, but I have never known a time when the older generation has been completely satisfied with the young, or the younger generation being completely satisfied with the old, because the younger generation certainly feels that the old generation doesn't understand them. And I must confess that there is a great deal of truth. I don't think generally there is a full understanding of the inner feelings and aspirations of youth. And because of this difference, there has always been something new that has been born in the world, and changes have come. That's one of the great contributions that have been made. That doesn't mean, therefore, that everything they rebel against is necessarily along right line, because I feel sometimes youth itself is not happy. They may appear to be happy because they make more noise about it than any of us, but very often there is dissatisfaction too, because they are seeking for something that will satisfy them inwardly. Neither the old generation nor the old teachings nor the old ways satisfy them, and they have not yet discovered the new way. And so they experiment with life. And while there may be misfortunes and unhappiness in the experiment, there is also a discovery which we have to understand. And if only there could be a little more understanding and feeling, I do feel that the young could be saved a great deal of unhappiness, and perhaps they could be helped to approach reality and to discover a reality that would give them inner satisfaction. We have to remember that nothing in the world is ever going to give us perfect satisfaction, because we will be satisfied perhaps with teachings or with philosophies or with life, with the beauty of life, many things, but we can never really be satisfied, because the only thing that is unsatisfactory in the world is not the world, but ourselves. And as long as we exist, we can never be satisfied. And the greatest problem for humanity is to know what to do with itself, rather than to know what to do with outside problems. And that is really the problem that will always exist. The search for happiness will be something which will go on forever and ever, because we do not know what to do with our own emotions, our own thoughts, and so on. These are the things that brings what you might call cataclysms in individual lives and cataclysms in national lives too, because there is the national consciousness which produces these revolutions, emotional, mental, and such revolutions also. Now, if you look at the world, we do find that in our own lifetime, there have been extraordinary changes that has taken place. And old values have had to give place to new. And probably there will be many more things yet to change, because we cannot be happy in this world as long as there is this fear of war, as long as there is the injustice, as long as there is cruelty, and so on. And we have to see what are the different things that will give us satisfaction. First, there was the world war. And you know how it is, we human beings seem to be born to learn through tragedies, because humanity has to discover wisdom through experience, has to discover truth through experience, individual experience and national experience. And because of that, the humanity goes through so much suffering, and because certain things does not answer rightly to our souls, we want something else. Does the nation, say as a political nation, supposing we seek for happiness, do the politics of the nation, does it satisfy you? Do we find that it really does justice to human feelings, human thoughts? Is it progressive? Does it reach out for something new? Is there something which is soul-satisfying? In the intellectual approach of man, is that satisfying? Is intellect satisfying? Is science satisfying? We find, however much we may study, there is always an element of dissatisfaction, because there has never been a real answer to not only to the problems of the world, but the problems of the individual. And we have to remember that there is no world problem which is not an individual problem. And it is the individual problem that has to be satisfied. If that is satisfied, then the world problem can be. You take, for example, one of the greatest forces in the world is the force of religion. Now, has religion absolutely satisfied humanity? And has it brought that solace, that peace, that answer to our inner questions? That is the thing we have to ask ourselves. Every great teacher who came upon earth, of course you must know that when I speak about religion, I speak about all religions, and we have to discuss from the point of view of all religions, because naturally I am one who believes in all religions. And when we look at it from a religious point of view, we know that every great teacher upon earth has come at a moment of great crisis, and he has brought an answer to the question of the human problem, and has tried to change that crisis into a great spiritual force. And when they did come, because of their personalities, because there was a question in the minds and the hearts of people which was coming to a culmination point of view, at that moment, a great psychological moment, the revelation of truth as experienced by a great teacher and as propounded to the people in such a way that it could be of value to them, and taking them to such a step by which they could really understand, they were able to give that inspiration, that quality, and supply that need which is in the heart of man. And that brought consolation. And of course, ultimately, that which brings consolation is not merely the philosophy, is not merely the teaching, but the life and the ability to enter into the hearts of people, because ultimately human beings, their happiness is really not merely bound with the mental satisfaction, but with the ability to feel deeply the most wonderful truths of life and to experience that reality. And it is once that human being is able to experience that reality, then he feels, he knows the truth, then he feels, he comprehends, then there is a happiness. Not a happiness because he has discovered the ultimate truth, but because he has discovered the truth by which he can learn more. Because real truth is not the ultimate discovery. Although sometimes we may have a tendency to think that all that can be said has been said. That is one of the things it's impossible to accept, because really truth is not what somebody says. It is what you experience. That is the truth. And it is the search for truth itself is the truth. And that's one of the things that you find very deeply in the Indian thought. And that is why there is a complete freedom of thought, while there is complete discipline of the body and the self-discipline of the body and mind. Now, while the great teachers gave this and gave to humanity that which their hearts were seeking for, there was satisfaction for some time. But they elevated our thoughts. They showed to the world that what we are seeking for, the happiness we are seeking for, cannot be found in things in which we are searching. It can only be found in something different, something that is lasting, that is of perpetual, eternal value, not that which is transient, like you and I are. But the unfortunate thing about humanity is that while they may be greatly inspired by these great teachers, that inspiration often led them to feel having that they have discovered something and they are the only things who possess that discovery. And this sense of possession of truth led very often not only to dogmatism, not only to differences, but also a sense of superiority. And that which the great teachers came to teach, which is brotherhood, which is that all life is one, finally that teaching itself became different from what the followers experienced. And so the result is that gradually an intolerance has grown and followers of religion have never been great enough for the real truths of religion. Have not really understood what religion is, and therefore religion had not given them that satisfaction. Not because the great teachers did not give it, but because the followers of religion have limited a philosophy that is an unlimited philosophy. Because human beings cannot for long take a philosophy which takes them too much trouble to experience. Because however great the Christ may be, or the Buddha may be, or Sri Krishna, or any of these great teachers, however great they are, what humanity wants is that they should be adapted to our mentality. We would rather that the Christ spoke what we wanted than what he wanted, if you know what I mean. And therefore, because of this, religion has not played the great part of bringing together and making those great changes in the world, although in reality, at that time, great changes did take place. But unfortunately, it has also brought about suffering because of intolerance, because of cruelties that perpetuated in the name of religion and so on. Later, it became cruelties in the name of race, then in the name of country, of power, some kind of power. It is this desire for power that really led humanity to bring so much disaster into the world. But even out of that, just as we may say that the crucifixion of the Christ was the most terrible blot upon humanity, yet even that has symbolized a very marvelous experience, and the experience of that one being is really ultimately the experience of all. And therefore, we come to a greater understanding and a greater truth by that suffering. And unfortunately, one of the major things that brings suffering has been war. And while we may have had wars individually in each country, finally, now we don't think of anything except in terms of the world. Very rarely does anybody speak about local war, because if there is a war somewhere in Korea, or if there is some trouble in the Suez Canal, or if there is some trouble in Malaysia, or some trouble somewhere else, subconsciously everybody wonders what its repercussions are going to be in the world. And in that way, we are more and more becoming dependent upon each other for our welfare and for peace. We are dependent upon each other in thousand ways, far more than we ever used to be. Now, the First World War, through that suffering, brought many, many extraordinary changes in the world. A new consciousness arose, and a new freedom came, and slowly an idea was born that there's only one way to bring peace in the world, that is unity. And that is why sometimes spiritual ideas, even great ideas, are born apparently in places and on the minds of people where you may not expect. You would normally never expect a spiritual idea to be born in the mind of a politician. But I think that is the blessing that we have. And so you find a great movement like the League of Nations came into existence because of the idea of the unity of all nations. But it was not satisfactory. It was a failure, mainly because humanity hadn't changed. We are never going to change the world by leagues, by contracts, by any kind of settlements or arrangements between politicians or people. The only way the world is going to change is by the change of character in every individual. And except by that change in the human heart, there can never be a political change either. Even a political change will definitely be not lasting, because the mental attitude of people have not changed. And because of that, it led, unfortunately, it's a strange thing that a peace treaty leads to war. And that is one of the peculiar things that has happened. The peace treaty of the First War was the beginning, the seeds were sown then for the Second War. And the Second War came with all its disaster, and it opened our eyes. I hope it did open our eyes, because people who talked about the civilized world, and everybody was feeling, well, we have a nice sophisticated way of life, and we are prosperous, we are comfortable, we have a kind of a code which we consider as civilized. Suddenly we begin to realize we are not civilized after all. Because as long as there is war, we might as well accept the fact we are not civilized. And certainly if ever there was lack of civilization, it was during that particular time. But we mustn't think of it in terms of a war brought up by a particular country. Sometimes people think, well, it's the Germans. But in reality, it's wrong to think in that way, because what we must learn from that is it's humanity. I don't see why we should think of it as one country. If one country is capable of it, I feel that another country is also capable, because when masses are aroused and when we come under the spell of certain influences, then unfortunately we cannot be responsible for what happened. Well, I saw this in India too. We never thought, because India has never been, there has never been, as far as we know, a great physical war of intolerance in the religion. Hinduism, there may have been intolerance in many ways because of caste distinction or because of other things, but never has there been a persecution. That has never happened. The physical persecution has never happened. And you find there, it is a country which has on the other hand welcomed every way of thinking and added that to our civilization. And if there are many religions in India, it is only because the difference did not matter so much as the attitude. If any man worshipped God, however differently he may do so, the very fact that his heart yearns towards that spirituality, that was welcomed. And that is why you will find the first Christians, the Parsis, and the many other were Jews and so on, found their refuge in India. And yet it came as a great shock to us at the time of the partition of India, when we found there was so much violence between the Hindus and the Mohammedans. And really the disillusionment was more on the Hindu side, because many Hindus felt, we have never shed blood in this way in the name of religion, and yet we have done it for the first time in history. Well, that is a proof of what masses can be, how different they can be under different circumstances. So we can never tell what the world is capable of, even what we are capable of. And the only way we can safeguard is to look at ourselves very carefully and see in what ways our minds and our hearts are changing, in what ways we are thinking differently, what are the things that are producing barriers between people. And certainly this search is not only an individual search, it is also a natural evolution of humanity. And it is because of this natural evolution and because of this suffering, new ideas have come. And the Second Great War brought certain new ideas. Certainly it brought many new ideas, more of a world nature. That is, the world consciousness in the sense, the United Nations came into existence, and all kinds of world organizations have come into existence. Not only that, but world movements of a spiritual nature also have come into existence. Of course, there were here and there, like the Theosophical movement, movements that were worldwide in order to bring the spiritual minds of people together, religions together and so on. But this has also grown. There is a fellowship of faith. There are many movements now which believe in the unity of all religions, the unity between races and so on. These thoughts are definitely coming more and more into the world. And you find that, and amongst the things, amongst the new discoveries for the world, I believe, have been, at least from a political and from an economic point of view, the discovery of the East. Of course, in the ancient times, people were conscious, after all, you know how India was discovered. There was a search. It's rather surprising to think. It really does surprise me to think. When I see the poverty of India, how at one time India could have attracted Western nations more for its wealth than for anything else. And it was very interesting also to see the difference in temperament, because to the West, it was an attraction from the point of view of wealth and the possibilities of growing wealth. The attraction in the East has been the attraction to the spiritual expression of India. And so many countries of the East have certainly derived their inspiration from the teachings of India. You find the whole of Southeast Asia very, very strongly culturally influenced by the Hindu thought and the Hindu philosophy. So much so that when I travel in Southeast Asia, sometimes I find certain customs, certain thoughts, certain artistic traditions too, which are lost in India, but which could be found in those countries. When you went to Tibet, and Tibet, which received its religion, Buddhism from India, there in the Tibetan monasteries and amongst the libraries, a great, wonderful manuscript, which we have heard about in India, which we thought had disappeared, and we now find that they have been kept in Tibet. And so if you go into the monasteries of China too, or anywhere else, you find that because of the influence of Buddhism in those countries, the influence of India had spread. So is Indonesia. And you find Sanskrit phraseology all over the East. Not only the East, even in the West, many parts of Russia, and so on. And this is a very interesting phenomena for me, because it gave me an idea as to the outlook of the people of that particular time. It looked as if the East found its inspiration in its culture and in its religion, while the West found its inspiration more in its material value. But whichever reason it may be, it did bring the East and the West together, at least on a certain plane, though not on the plane of full understanding. The full understanding only came amongst a few who had stayed in India and who had imbibed the spirit of the great philosophies and propounded it to the Western world to show the East is not, after all, so uncivilized as we possibly think. And now, because of the many changes that are taking place, and the Eastern countries have attained their own freedom, and they are beginning to discover their own strength. Because of that, the Eastern nations are definitely expressing their own voices in all the world affairs. What kind of a voice is being expressed? That is another question. Because unfortunately, the East, which was inspired by the philosophy of the great teachers of India and others too, of course China had wonderful teachers, but which was inspired, is definitely becoming now, I would say, very positively becoming something different from its own nature. You can see in China and elsewhere that the whole of the East, and culturally we can see that the East is becoming westernized. And as I said in the beginning, the East certainly knows far more about the West than the West does about the East. This is not a theory, it is an absolute fact, because you can speak to any educated Indian, he will be able to give you something of the knowledge of the history of Western people, something perhaps, if they are artistic, about the Western art, they would speak about the literature of the West, but I am afraid even the elementary knowledge of the East is very much lacking in Western countries. Although here and there seems to be a kind of interest. Of course, the interest has been in some ways, in strange ways. In America at one time, they thought India was composed entirely either of yogis or of maharajas. Now they don't think of that. They now talk neither of yogis nor of maharajas. They ask you about the cows that are wandering about the streets, or about the poverty in our country, and so on. Well, all these things may be true, but really, if we are really to discover each other, then the discovery is not so much on what happens superficially, saying what do we do for food, what is the kind of agriculture. Of course, all this elementary knowledge we must have. Unfortunately, even that many people do not have. But although we must have that, the only real exchange can only be when the East begins to discover itself again. It is natural that it should be westernized. When I say westernized, I don't mean in the sense that there is nothing good to learn in Western civilization. If the exchange between the East and West has been on a spiritual, philosophical, and cultural level, then I would say it is a wonderful exchange. And that is the one and only exchange that will ultimately bring the worlds together. But if the exchange is merely an exterior form of merely copying that which is obviously superficial, or that which is obviously uncultured, if I may put it in that particular way, then it is an unfortunate copying, and the result will be not a real meeting of the East and West, but more the worst of the East and the worst of the West meeting together. And this is the thing which we have to avoid. But in the Western world, there is also a growing interest. There are many changes that are taking place. First, the consciousness of the East. And also there is a certain interest in the deeper philosophies and the teachings of East, particularly of India, and there is a very slow awakening. And then there is the consciousness of the idea of the unity of humanity, that people must face certain facts and they must remove certain barriers without which there can never be the emergence of true culture or spiritual values in the world. One of the changes, certainly in the religious world, has been, you know, probably in the East, a gradual deterioration in the appreciation of religion and perhaps giving up religion and taking to something different. But in spite of it, the Eastern temperament is deep within itself, a temperament that is ideally suited to the understanding of philosophy and of religion. And therefore I believe that this phase will gradually disappear and there will be again a regaining of the consciousness of, or a desire to understand the spiritual values. When they are dissatisfied with the material side, gradually the mind will turn to the spiritual. And in Western countries, also here and there, there are people who are beginning to think of the whole spiritual conception from a much larger and wider point of view. The Christian world, one of the new things that has happened is the fact of the unity of the Christian, of all the Christian faiths. That is certainly a very, very remarkable event that is taking place. Because one of the things that used to interest people in India was when a missionary tried to convert, well, their idea was, they would say, but you must join, if you join the Roman Catholic Church, then you are a better Christian than if you join some other church. And it seemed as if it was not enough to believe in the Christ, but it was more necessary to believe in the particular expression of the formal religion. Well, that probably will disappear in the Christian world, and only thing I would like to see is one step further. And that step further would be not only a unity of all the Christian, of all the different varieties of Christians, but a unity between all religions. That I believe is going to be and should be the next great step in the work. And in order to do that, naturally, there would have to be a deeper understanding and a study of the essential qualities of religion. Because you must remember, religion is not just religion. It is customs, social customs, habits, all kinds of things have been put together in the name of religion. And we should not study that. We will never understand. But if we study the basic truths and the teachings, we will find ultimately the same great message that has been taught in the world. Now, one of the great forces for, I believe, a spiritual relief in the world amongst all these changes is, and that which will help to change the hearts of men, because, you know, after all, what is needed now is a change of heart and nothing else. We have the intellectual approach because modern world is the world of science. Science is the great dominant force. And in a way, science does help humanity to come to a kind of a common platform of thought, because when it is science, there is no such thing as a national science. Science is the understanding of nature and its forces, and nature is the same everywhere. But science can never satisfy or change the heart of man, because while science gives a mental satisfaction and knowledge, it is never going to serve the great purpose that the spiritual satisfaction can be. And this mental satisfaction can only change when we have the refinement, the elevation, and the change in our emotional side as well. And it is this which I believe is going to civilize man. Because what man needs to be, if he wants to be spiritual, he is to become civilized. And he can only be civilized by influences that are not either only of the mind or only about politics, not even, if I may say so, of religion alone. Because true religion is not merely that which you believe or the dogmas or doctrines, but the experience of the human soul, the experience of life, the experience of the one life. The world has come gradually coming to an idea of one life, although in practice you will find a great deal of separation, race prejudices still exist. Now the greatest influence, I believe, which will refine man and civilize him and bring the world together, on which there is no barrier at all, that is the influence of art and of beauty. Culture, in my opinion, is the new language of the world. Culture is the language of the soul. And culture does not mean merely an exterior expression of art, because art is a mere symbol of a way of life. Culture means a complete living, a complete harmony with life and with all that lives. And it is that alone which I believe will bring the world together and humanity to understand values which are different. What we need is a little imagination, that's all. Because very often we are under the influence of narrow conceptions which we have brought with us. And we must have the courage to break away from those narrow conceptions. We cannot have the courage unless we are free. We cannot be free unless we have imagination, and unless we have sensitiveness. The sensitiveness and imagination is a great quality that must influence man, and it is through it that he will have a true spiritual perception, and then he will know not only what Christ teaches, but what he is, what he feels. We will have the experience of the spiritual life. And this is a very important thing, because until we have that experience, I am afraid we will never know what is happiness. And we all want happiness, and we all want it at the cost of somebody else. Of course, if possible, we would like to have it without hurting someone else. But unfortunately, we are interdependent in the world. And the only way we can be released from our constricting thoughts and minds is to be free inwardly. There is a freedom that we all seek for, freedom of speech, freedom of language, freedom of thought. Even that, I do not know how much we all have, or we have the courage to express, but we want that inner freedom which contacts the spiritual life and which makes us feel the spirit of unity with every living creature upon earth. And I believe that the world must now go from the thought of the one world to the thought of the one life. And it is only by that expression, by that experience, we shall know what is the spiritual, what are spiritual values. And what is happening today? The president of India, Dr. Radhakrishnan, who is a great philosopher, once he said, there are so many things that are happening in the world which we call a crisis. There is a political crisis. There are other crises in the world. Certainly a political crisis is going on all the time. But he said one thing which is completely true. The greatest crisis is the crisis in character. And I think we can all agree the greatest crisis today is the crisis in character. Because man has not yet found himself, he has not yet discovered the reality. And we are going through a phase, you know, in the world which is more dominated by the mind, by analysis, by arguments. And no spiritual life can be understood by arguments. There is another inner argument, which is the argument of sensitiveness, which cannot be explained. If you ask, so, you know, if you argue, why is a rose flower beautiful? Well, you can't answer. It is beautiful, that's all. So truth is truth, and you cannot argue about it. And therefore, we must transcend that mind, which in one of the great books of the East is called the Slayer of the Real, which destroys reality. We must transcend from that to the level of intuition by which we discover the truth and reality and the spiritual values which we can apply to every aspect of life by which life itself changes. That we have to know. And to quote again Dr. Radhakrishnan, which he said something very profound, I felt, the other day. He said, this modern world is a world that lives in either physical, emotional or mental excitement. What it wants during the day is a stimulant, and what it wants at night is they call it some other name.
Tranquilizer,
yes. So what we do is, we live, the world is living today on tranquilizers and stimulants at the same time. And really, I think that is very well put. This is the world today of tranquilizers. And then having become tranquil, we want stimulant. Because there is an inner restlessness. And there is no, that restlessness can never be understood unless we open our minds and we have the courage first to understand the world, the problems of the world, and by that to understand ourselves, and then to discover a way which to us is the one real way of experience, irrespective of what others think, to have the courage to think differently, to be different, to be your own self, and to ultimately discover that the spiritual values in life is the one thing the world is now seeking for, whether it is war or earthquake, whether it is politics or science, whether it is religion or art. In all, there is going through a revolution towards the discovery of this reality, which alone will ultimately bring happiness and peace to all. I cannot say I have answered, because no one can answer. But what I can say is, let us think. Let us think, and think for ourselves, and let us try to feel the truth, the reality, so that it becomes a wonderful experience to each one of us. The Lord Buddha said to his disciple, do not merely accept everything I say because I say it. Let it become your experience as well. And learn, he said to his disciple, learn to be a lamp unto yourself. And when you have learned to be a lamp unto yourself, you will find that darkness will never come upon this earth for you.